Thank you. Great. Good morning, everybody. So good to be here. Gosh, you go to Kroger once in a while? You know, I've got this bad habit of when I go over to someone's house, I inevitably find a reason to look in their refrigerator. And it's like, this milk, why would you go there? I promise I just went one time. I'll never go again. Well, it's a pleasure to be here with you. And it's funny, I've been spending some time on the University of Houston campus working with college students, in particular some students who aren't sure that they're going to be able to make it through college and have been dealt a tough hand in life and trying to figure out, can they make it through school, either financially or from a commitment standpoint. And it's been very rewarding. But in doing that, one of the things that occurred to me, and I don't know if you found this, but the things that I learned in college that I really use on a daily basis, I might could fill one side of a 3x5 note card. And if you think about college to a great extent, a lot of it is the experience that you go through. I mean, if I had to do a calculus problem, my family would go very hungry. But the older that I've gotten, it's occurred to me that there are things I didn't learn in college that I had to learn along the way that really would have been good if someone had mentored me or taught me earlier on. And so for some of you, these may be things you can relate to or maybe have thought about, and for others, it may not. But I just thought I would share with you three things that I wish someone had talked to me about when I was earlier, because it might have made my life a little bit easier along the way. And the first of those was that I wish someone had told me when I was younger that it was okay to fail. Because I was raised in an amazing family. My parents were married for 64 years. I don't think they ever spent more than 3 nights away from each other. I have one sister who, by coincidence, is visiting me here this week. She just turned 75. She and I are 18 and a half years apart, and there are only two of us, which means my middle name is Whoops. And I married my high school sweetheart. We've been married for 33 years. We have two wonderful daughters who moved away, got married, and now have moved back to Houston. Been blessed with a new grandchild. I was raised in a family where you just didn't talk about anything you were worried about or anything you failed on. I mean, just wasn't what you did. And the thing about failure, I was reading something, and there is a historian named Froude who said that the worth of a man must be measured by his life, not his failure, under a single and peculiar trial. Peter the Apostle, though forewarned, thrice denied his master on the first alarm of danger. Yet the master, who knew his nature and its strength and its infirmity, chose him. Now for me, and I've thought about this for years and years, is whether I'm more motivated by the thrill of victory or the absolute fear of failure. And I know for maybe the first 25 years that I worked, I was scared to death of getting fired, like, all the time. I think back to when I was in my early 20s, actually having the conversation with myself of thinking, okay, I can just save a little bit more money, then I'll have 3 months' pay saved up, so when I get fired, then I'll be able to make it till I can find another job, despite the fact I think I was about to get promoted. But I just had this nagging fear, and a lot of it, I think this fear of failure stems from a need to be in control. A belief that if I can be in control, then I can succeed. And not wanting to show any level of vulnerability, a desire to want to fix things on my own rather than have to rely on others, and generally an unwillingness to have faith. And it's something that I've struggled with all my life. You know, for me, it's not the typical male thing, attribute of not wanting to ask for directions. In fact, when Siri gives me directions, I'm convinced I know a better way to get there than what Siri tells me. So the fact is that over the course of our lives, we're all going to fail, and often we're going to fail miserably, because I know I have in my life. Last year, I tore my Achilles tendon, and I've always tried to be an overachiever. I didn't tear it once. I tore it 5 times. And after I tore it the first time, I tore it the same week that Tyrell Suggs from the Baltimore Ravens tore his. And 6 months later, I was going through surgery number 4, and he was back on the field. But when I tore it the first time, I was convinced that I could rehab like an NFL player because I was special. And so if the physical therapist told me to do 3 sets of 10, I did 30 sets of 10. And so then I promptly tore it again. Why? Because I was convinced that I was not going to fail. I was never going to have to run slower. I was going to be better than everyone else, and I was special. Now, often we don't get things right the first time we try them. And the company I work for at HEB is a good case in point. We were founded in 1905 by a woman whose husband had tuberculosis. And so they moved from Tennessee to the hill country because they thought that it would be better for his respiration, although there are a lot of cedar trees there. And he was too sick to work. And so she opened up a little grocery store in the first floor of her house. They live upstairs. And the first store did well. They would actually deliver groceries door to door in a wagon. So they decided, hey, we'll open up a second store. And they did, and it failed. And they opened up a third store, and it failed. A fourth store, and it failed. A fifth store, and it failed. I don't know about you, but I can guarantee if I tried something once and I failed the next five times when I was that age, I probably would have become a plumber or something. I don't think I would have stuck with the grocery store thing. Thomas Edison tried 9,000 times to get the light bulb right before it finally went on. Colonel Sanders tried to sell chicken to 1,000 different people to get them to take it on before he ever hit the mark. But in life, there's a big difference between playing to win versus playing not to lose. And we see it on TV in football every Saturday or every Sunday. You get ahead, you try not to blow the lead, and then you end up blowing the lead. And you wonder how many people choose to play small because they're terrified of failure. I know that I did, especially when I was younger, thinking that, okay, I'm going to do whatever it takes to not get fired instead of what can I do to potentially realize greatness. So I was constantly thinking, well, what if I get fired, or what if they don't like what I've done, or what if I make a mistake? But there was this fear and lack of being willing to be vulnerable to others that I was going to avoid at all costs. I had a vice president who worked for me a few years back who was so terrified of making a bad decision that he would make no decision. He suffered from a bad case of analysis paralysis, and I finally had to sit him down and let him know that by choosing to do nothing, you were in de facto making a decision to not do anything, which didn't necessarily move things forward. Now, when you fail and you fall down, it hurts, even when you're 56 years old like I am. The year that I became president and I moved to Houston, HEB that year lost $45 million, which in grocery store terms is a lot of money. Now, our owner, Charles Butt, he's a billionaire many times over. But he called me in the middle of that first year I was over here and said, Scott, do you realize that you're losing about $1 million a week? And it was right then I realized that he and I were very similar, that at the bottom of our pockets we both had lint, and that I either needed to figure out to do something differently or somebody else was going to be doing something differently. And what I've found is that you learn a lot more about yourself when you fail than you do when you succeed. That you learn a lot more about what's possible, and you're more introspective when you go through and do that. And I think I learned a lot more that first year when we were losing so much money than I did in subsequent years when things have gone really relatively well. All of us in our lives have experienced a series of crucible moments. Now, a crucible experience is a transformational experience that produces a fundamental change in how you look at the world and how it occurs to you and what your place in it is. And virtually all crucible experiences can be segmented into three different types of things that have happened. A first one would be mentoring relationships. So someone who took an interest in you, someone who looked after you, someone when things weren't going well took you under their arm. We've all had them in some way, shape, or form. Mine occurred when I was in the fourth grade. I had got it in my mind early on in the fourth grade that studying really wasn't very important. That was for the other guys. For me, you know, it was really more about having a good time. And my fourth grade teacher didn't agree with that. And I can remember after the first quarter, you have the parent-teacher conferences, and she was nice enough to invite me to the parent-teacher conference with her parents, to whom all three of us, she explained that really there was more to an educational experience than what I was putting in. And so after I got beat when I got home, I remember that I had a new set of priorities on it, but this woman, through her intervention and her consistent, which I felt at the time was nagging, really got me more focused on thinking that going to school and studying was something of being important versus time you spent until you could get to lunch and to PE, which I really liked a lot better. A second type of crucible experience that people have is what's called insertion into foreign territory, which is when you're thrust into an experience that you have no experience with, you aren't sure what to do, and as you figure out how to get through it, somehow something changes for you in your life. For me, that was in 2006 when Hurricane Rita came. I can remember at the time that the hurricane was bearing down. This was right after Katrina had hit, and it was coming our way, and of course, we knew what Katrina did. And I said to my number two guy, who'd been with the company for 25 years, "You ever done a hurricane?" And he said, and I said, "Me neither." And we said, "Well, what should we do?" And we decided, well, we'd fake it till we made it. That was kind of our strategy in getting through the hurricane. And our goal was to shut our stores last and open our stores first and use that as a way to really get people to shop more with us and feel that HEB had made the extra effort. And so what we did, as the eye of the hurricane was passing through Houston, people in the Rio Grande Valley and Corpus Christi and San Antonio and Austin who worked for HEB got in their cars and started driving here so we could put the stores back together. Well, the hurricane didn't hit Houston, it hit Beaumont, but it really hit Beaumont. And I'd never seen anything like the power of a hurricane, the tremendous power of God when you can just snap trees like matchsticks, take the canopies of gas stations and twist them like breadsticks. It really was phenomenal. And FEMA at the time, who'd gotten so much accolade over their good work in Katrina, had said, hey, we don't want anyone to come to Beaumont, we want everyone to leave. Well, as you can imagine, there were plenty of people in the Beaumont area who chose not to leave, and once the hurricane passed, they weren't gonna leave because they just wanted to put things back together. And so I can remember I tried to charter a helicopter to go over and meet with FEMA, but they wouldn't meet with us. Meanwhile, I had 9 stores over there that didn't have any electricity, and when you have dairy and produce and meat that is not on air conditioning, after about a day, it gets to be a rather stinky affair. So we got 150 people and we put them on buses. And in front of the buses, we took an Escalade and got a blue light that flashed. And they had an official letter from me that authorized them to enter Beaumont. By notice of this letter, you are authorized, these buses are authorized to go in and reopen the HEB stores. And so they drove out to Beaumont, and the police stopped them, and they handed them the letter, and he read it, and they said, okay. And so this fake it till you make it thing really kind of worked. And as I thought about it, you know, for 35 years, I've made a career out of this. And but it really was a crucible moment for me in terms of trying to figure out, and I wasn't in the military, but it was maybe as close to a military operation as what I had ever run into. And the third type of crucible moment that really can define our lives is through disruption or loss. The loss of someone you're close to, the loss of a relationship, some disruption that occurred in your life. And the one that sticks out in my mind is that when I was 16, my first car was a 1971 Volkswagen. And I needed gas in it, and I didn't have any money, so I took a couple bucks out of my dad's money clip, and gas then was 20 cents a gallon, so 22 bucks was gonna get me some gas. So I was outside on a Saturday morning washing my car, and unbeknownst to me, my dad counted his money. I don't know why he did this, maybe he was a depression kid, but he counted his money in his money clip, and he came out, and he said, hey, could I borrow a couple of bucks? And means pretty stupid, I said, yeah, sure, and I gave him the $2. And then I got hit upside of the head. And then he said to me this, which almost 40 years later, I still remember like it was today. He said, I'm not gonna tell your mother because this would hurt her too much. And he turned around and he walked away. Now, to qualify as a crucible event, it really has to alter the way you see and interpret a situation, what's your role in it, and it has an impact on the rest of your life. And subsequently, your behavior is changed in accordance with your new and altered view of how life occurs. And it was right then, in that moment, that I made a decision that I was never going to have my integrity brought into question again by anything that I did. For many, hope is a function of struggle. And often those with the highest level of hope are those who've had the greatest experience with failure. I've got a good friend who happens to be a Holocaust survivor. Naomi Warren is in her early 90s now. She was raised in Poland married at a young age to a doctor, came from a well-to-do family, and went through the Holocaust. And she tells the story. She was in line after having ridden on a rail car for 3 days with her mother, and her mother, looking out, saw that the line split into older people and young, very young children on the fork, and kind of more capable people on the left. And when they got up to where the line forked, she pushed Naomi in one direction, and she went in the other, and Naomi never saw her mother again, nor her father, nor her husband, nor her sister-in-law, nor her cousins. And after the Holocaust, she came to America, and she said that she commented that she was raised spoiled and self-absorbed, and that the Holocaust made her not just tougher, but made her more empathetic, and in fact, she felt that the Holocaust made her a better person. And I can remember when she said this, just being dumbfounded. I'm sure that my mouth was wide open, like, you're telling me that the Holocaust made you better? I just, in such shock out of that. And she said that when she sailed into New York City and saw the Statue of Liberty, that she made a decision that while she wasn't going to forget her past, she wasn't going to let it define her, and she decided to live her life moving forward. And so she met another Holocaust survivor, and they moved to Houston. And ironically, being a Jew, he owned a Danish ham company and imported hams, and then started a meat packing plant with making deli meats. And they had 3 kids, and 8 years later, he died of a heart attack. And so here's Naomi, a Holocaust survivor, who's never worked, with 3 kids, and she took over the meatpacking plant. And she didn't speak particularly good English, and she said to me the first time she ever called on HEB that she wrote her speech out, and she just read it so that she wouldn't make a mistake in her thick Polish accent. Her company went on to be the only company that's won an excellence award from HEB since we've been giving it. She sold her company to Tyson, is now retired. But I've just been amazed by her and another friend of mine who's a Holocaust survivor, how he said, as I said to him, his name's Walter Case, Walter, how can you not be bitter? And he said, I've seen hate in my life, and all I have room for anymore is love. And so you look at these crucible experiences and how they can define what happens in your life, and how failure thrust upon you by someone else had such an incredible impact on them. Philippians 3:13, one thing I do, forgetting those things which are behind and reaching forward to those things which are ahead. And so as I think back on my own failure, it really was more steeped in the past and thinking about what was and what I couldn't do instead of looking forward to what could be. Now, the second thing that I wish that they had taught me in college was to be a better listener. And it reminds me of the story of the most pious woman in town. You see, this woman was in her house when a big storm was headed towards the town, and the fire department was evacuating, knocked on their door and said, you need to evacuate your house. There could be bad flooding. You need to leave. And she said, you know, God has always looked out for me. I think I will stay here. And the storm came, and in fact, it did flood her house, and she moved from the first floor up to the second floor. And the fire department came by in a raft and said, old woman, you need to get into the raft because the water is raising so high you could die. She said, not to worry. God has always looked out for me. I think I'll be just fine. And the rain came even harder, and she had to climb onto her roof, at which time the Coast Guard helicopter flew over. And over the loudspeaker, the pilot said, ma'am, you need to get in the helicopter because the rain is still coming. You're going to drown. And she said, no, God has always looked after me. And it rained even harder. She got swept off her roof, and she died. She drowned. So she got to heaven, and she said, God, what happened? I thought you were going to take care of me. And he said, take care of you? Old woman, you weren't listening. I sent you 2 firemen and the Coast Guard. And you think about listening, it reminds me of a quote from Winston Churchill that said, courage is what it takes to stand up and speak, but courage is also what it takes to sit down and listen. And I think for many of us, we think about courage as being something to get into action and something to do, as opposed to how can you involve others. There was a guy that worked for me when I ran marketing. He was really a smart guy. We'd hired him from Harvard. He had an MBA. He'd worked his way through, and he was a guy that was committed to getting to the top and, you know, being a big player at HEB. And at one point, he came forth and he said, look, There was a job that was open running our private label items, the development of all of our, we call them own brand, not private label, all of our own brand. It's one of maybe one of the best jobs in all of HEB. And I said, you know, I'd really want to do this. I've got an offer to go somewhere else. If I could do this, I'll stay. So we put him in charge. Charles Butt, who I work for, is really an interesting guy. And so we put him in this job, Rob Price in this job. And the first 30 days, you literally could see smoke coming out of the windows of his office. He was strategizing. He was building a plan. He was reorganizing. He was looking at his assortment. He was looking at quality. I mean, he was just going to town. And after 30 days, Charles called him and said, hey, Rob, I'd like you to come over and provide me with an update of what it is that you've been doing. And so he's got this big deck, and he brings the deck over and sets it on the table with Charles and begins to take him through the presentation of everything that he's been doing and working these 16-hour days around the clock to make sure that he's making a difference in what he's doing. And about 20 minutes into it, and he was only through like a quarter of the deck, Charles said, hey, Rob, I need to stop you. And Rob's like, yes, sir? And he said, I need to let you know you're failing. And it was like someone hit him across the jaw with a left hook. I mean, because for 30 days, he had just plowed his heart and soul into making sure he was off to a great start. And he said, failing? How can you say I'm failing? And Charles said, you've been so busy doing that you haven't taken any time to listen to what it is that you need to do. And if you think about it, if you rearrange the letters in the word listen, that you can spell the word silent. And I don't know about you, but oftentimes when I'm in a discussion with someone, I'm so busy thinking about what I'm going to say next that I don't really take into account what it is that they're saying in the first place. And for Rob Price, frankly, it was a situation he never got over. He left us in about another year because he couldn't get over the fact that Charles had said he was failing, and he didn't get the fact that you can learn an awful lot more from listening. It was maybe 15 years ago now, I was down on a Sunday with Charles Butt making stores, visiting stores in the Rio Grande Valley. And we went into one store in Mission, it was like 3 p.m, and he said to one of the managers up front, if you go into one of our stores, that'd be one of the people in the blue shirt, a first level manager, and he said, hey, have you got time for me to buy you soda? And she said, yes, sir, Mr. Butt, sure. And so we sat down, and so I'm sitting down, and he said, tell me a little bit about yourself. And he said, I'm married, I have a couple of kids. How long have you worked here? And he said, tell me, how much do I pay you? And she said, this was a number of years ago, she said, you pay me $10 an hour. And do you work full time? She said, yes. And you could see Charles, so he did 10 times 40 is 400, times 4 is 1600. And said, now your husband, where does he work? And he said, well, he works at Home Depot. And, well, how much does he make? He makes $24,000 a year. He said, I don't mean to pry, I'm just curious. And so Charles then wrote $2,000. And for that would have been his monthly pay, and then added the $1,600 of that, $3,600, and then said, now, do you guys own a house? Oh, no, we can't afford to own a house, sir. Oh, well, I don't mean to be nosy, but what do you have to pay in rent? Oh, we pay $700 a month in rent. And what Charles began to do was to build an income statement for this woman, because what he was really interested in is, was he paying her a living wage? Because if you don't pay someone a living wage and you're just a toll stop, until they can find a job that does pay them a living wage. And this story has gone on to be of urban legend at HEB, and many people tell it. I was there. And it really was a fascinating thing. Here's a man who is a billionaire that took the interest in someone that was a first-line manager for him, and was he, in fact, paying her? Now, I've had a similar experience to Rob Price in my own career. I grew up in Southern California. I went to USC. I graduated from USC, and I went to work at Frito-Lay. And like everyone at Frito-Lay, I started driving a route truck, delivering potato chips to supermarkets and convenience stores and restaurants and places like that. And I was fortunate. I was at Frito. If you didn't get promoted in management, then you were going to get fired. It was either up or out. And so I was lucky as I got transferred eight. I guess I was lucky. I got transferred 8 times in 10 years. At one point, when my wife was 8.5 months pregnant, I owned 3 houses in 3 cities and really had no money because I was 24 years old. And our last job there was with Frito, as I was running sales for Frito-Lay Canada. And we were about to get transferred to either Delhi or Istanbul. And you admit, when you live internationally, and maybe some of you had, yeah, I think you're either an internationalist or you're not. But I missed flour tortillas and Dr. Pepper And so when the opportunity came to move to Texas, I jumped at it and I went to work for HEB and I took a job where I ran 70 grocery stores. Although I had never worked in a grocery store other than on the chip aisle. And in about 4 weeks, I went from unconscious incompetence to unconscious, I went from unconscious incompetence to conscious incompetence when I realized, oh my God, I don't know what I've got myself into. And I remember my wife saying to me, well, how do you think things are going? And I said, if they find out, I have no idea what I'm doing. We are in deep trouble here. And 23 years later, I know just a little bit more. But I learned early on, and I got a lot of this from my dad, was that while I might not have been the sharpest tool in the shed, that I was going to work hard, and that competition got a lot easier after 40 hours. And while someone might be smarter, they weren't going to work harder than me, and I threw myself completely into my job. In 1975, I was made the senior vice president of marketing, and I was told that year that I was being groomed to be the COO and run the company. And so I played to get promoted, because by God, I wanted to be the COO. That was my rightful place in the world, and no one was going to deny it. And I was in firm control of my future, and I was going to ascend to the job that I coveted, and my job defined me. I was the first one in, I was the last one out. And in looking back, while I wasn't a bad husband or father, if you go into my home, you weren't going to see any plaques or medals or ribbons adorning me for what a good job I was doing. I never drove my kids to school, not even once. If somebody had to go to the doctor, thank God I was married way above my my pay grade. That was what my wife did. And what I did was I let myself go spiritually and physically. From a philanthropic standpoint, I was the CEO of the Scott McClellan Charity, whose focus in life was to get promoted. And the harder that I worked to try to show others that I was indeed the right person to run the company, the more evident it became to others that I wasn't. And so instead of playing to win, I played not to lose, and looking good wasn't high on my priority list. It's a little bit like if you've ever seen these Chinese finger cuffs that are made out of straw, and you put your fingers into them, and the harder you try to pull your fingers out, the less likely you are to get them out. You just become handcuffed. And I was completely blind to it because I didn't listen. I wasn't interested in what other people had to say because I was going to run the company and they needed to be interested in what I was going to say. I was a little bit, and maybe this happens when you walk your dog. I walk my dog. She always has to lead. She has no idea where we're going. She's going to be in front and going somewhere. And that was me. I was the dog on the choker chain that was going to get to someplace where I thought we should go. And it became clear to others that I wasn't going to be the person to run the company. And when I found out that I wasn't going to be the COO, I felt like I'd failed. Now, when you're met with failure in your life, there are three things that you can do. You can quit, you can sulk, or you can change your approach, dust yourself off, and get back in the game. And so as I was sulking, a funny thing happened. When it became evident I wasn't going to get promoted, I finally slowed down enough to listen to others and maybe most importantly to listen to God. And through prayer, I realized that I could define myself more holistically, not just as an HEB partner, but as a husband and a father and a friend. It never occurred to me really to think about what kind of friend did I want to be. Friend was somebody who was going to help me get promoted. And while it sounds kind of crappy, it was true. I was going to be as a Christian, as a philanthropist, as being someone who's physically fit. And it became clear to me through this process that with all these different roles I could fill, that I could find a lot more joy in being all of them instead of putting all my eggs in one basket and just trying to be the COO of HEB. And one of the first sermons that I ever heard Dave Peterson preach, he said, he asked whether I'd be willing to give up the best thing I knew in order to get something better. And this is what I faced at that time in my life, because I thought my career was the best and most important thing that I had going. It defined who I was, and when I was faced with the disappointment of it not matching my expectations, it really opened my eyes to the potential for a bigger and better life. What happened was God helped me change my context in my life. I read a book a few years ago called Chasing Daylight by a guy named Gene O'Kelly, and he was the CEO of KPMG. And in the book, he writes about a book he never finished writing up to the last chapter. He didn't write the last chapter because he died, but he was diagnosed with terminal brain cancer and he was given 100 days to live. And in the book, he deals with the question of, must the end of my life be the worst part of it? or could it possibly be made to be the best? And the book is really a powerful testament to the human spirit as he reflects on success and love and spirituality and life and death. And what was powerful to me in reading this book was O'Kelly's ability to redefine happiness and fulfillment based on the hand that he had been dealt, because he was able to change his personal context as opposed to feeling that he had to be in control. He used his life-ending illness to his benefit. And I guess what's somewhat ironic for me in my own life is that once I began to focus more on enjoying life and being a more holistic person, my life got back on track and I got promoted. It's a weird thing. I mean, I wasn't trying so hard. I thought I was just going to live in San Antonio the rest of my life, and I woke up one day and I was here. And maybe my courage was manifested in a willingness to walk away from what was familiar, what I felt like I knew how to do, from having to be in control of my life, of having to be in charge of my destiny, and having a willingness in the faith to put my hands, my future, and my beliefs in the hands of others. Because when I took time to listen to God, I saw him influencing parts of my life that I'd never seen before. And the term that we use for this in my family is God incidence. More than a coincidence, because when you take the time to listen to the Holy Spirit speaking to you, you can see God's handprints on top of everything that's happening in your life. But when you're so focused on you and everything else that's happening in your life, if you don't take the time to take it all in and see it, you would never see it. And my final point was the importance of living generously. And contrary to what I thought, that the world revolved solely around me and my place in it, is that through this process I went through, I came to realize that each of us can make a big difference in the lives of others, and often we underestimate just how much impact we can have and one person can have on others. Now, Proverbs 11:24 says, "One gives freely, yet grows all the richer." My wife's grandmother, who I knew since I was 17 years old, lived with us for the last 20 years of her life. She died when she was 105. And she was an old Greek woman, spoke five languages. She was so funny. And what she would always say to us in her thick Greek accent is, "You know, if you do good things, it will come back to you double." And I really think that she was right, because the times that I've given myself to others, I always walk away feeling like I'm the one that received the gift, as opposed to having done something nice for someone else. And sometimes it's as insignificant as seeing that something just doesn't appear to be right with someone and saying, "Hey, I just noticed something seems off. What's up? Something, anything going on?" And then you'd be amazed at how much people will open up. It reminds me of that story. Maybe you've seen the movie before where the guy is standing on the beach and there are starfish everywhere, and he's picking up a starfish and throwing it in the water, and they've all washed up on the shore. Picks up a starfish and throws it into the water, and a guy comes up and says, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm throwing starfish in the water." And he said, "You can't possibly save all of these starfish from, you know, now that the tide has gone out." And he said, "I can't save them all, but I can save this one." Now, other times, in being generous, it's about taking a stand in something that you strongly believe in. My closest friend from the sixth grade, his name is Todd Whitthorn, and he lives in Dallas. And he called me. His daughter went to A&M, and she was an education major. And in her student teaching in a very poor school in Bryan, she met a kid in her class that she thought was really bright. And as she got to know him and her family, she said to her dad, "He's never going to have the chance to make it. His mom's never had a job. She's never been married. She's got two other brothers. They move from family member to family member. The odds are stacked against him. Life isn't going to work out." And so I was talking to my friend on the phone. He said, "You know, I'm going to do something that's kind of out of the box." He said, "I've given money to a lot of charities over the years, but I really don't know if it's ever made a difference." He said, "But I think I can make a difference in this kid." And so what he did was he moved the woman and her three kids into his house. And I can remember getting goosebumps hearing that and feeling relatively insignificant on anything nice I'd try to do in my life. And I marveled, but he said to me, "I'm teaching this young man things like how to shake your hand with a firm grip and look me in the eye, because I think I can make a difference in his life." And he got the mother a job. And he bought a house, his friends gave him furniture, they moved her into the house, she got a car, and they were on their way. And so you think about that old analogy of the bacon and egg breakfast, you know, the chicken was involved, but the pig was committed. I mean, here was an example where my friend, and I say this in a loving way, was the pig. So there's a movie that I saw a number of years ago, and to this day, it's maybe one of my favorite two or three movies of all time. It starred Kevin Spacey, Helen Hunt, and Haley Joel Osment, called Pay It Forward. And the story is about this middle-aged, if you haven't seen it, go rent it tonight. It's so good. It's about this middle school kid that is giving a task in his class for extra credit to change the world. And so he comes up with this idea of he's going to do a good deed for three people, and he's not going to ask for anything in return, only that they then do a good deed for three people, and that they pay it forward. And so one becomes three, and three becomes nine, and nine becomes 27, and I can't do the math beyond that. But he realized that by doing three good deeds that maybe he could change the world and make it a better place to world. And I think we can each be a link in our pay it forward chain. And frankly, I think that we need to think of it not so much as a responsibility, but as a right. Because isn't that what the golden rule is all about? I was reading an article a couple weeks ago about a guy and what he was going to put on his gravestone, and he decided to put under his name, leave good footprints. And I just thought that was incredibly powerful, because you can leave an impression on others, which each and every encounter, every conversation, you can either propel what is potential and what can happen in someone's life, or you can diminish it in what you do. And whether we're delivering pleasant news or difficult news, how we conduct ourselves, how we say things will have a big impact on other people. Thomas Watson once said, really big people above everything else, courteous, considerate, and generous, not to just some people in some circumstances, but to everyone all of the time. And I think what I've come to realize is that a movement starts with a single person and their commitment, like my friend Todd, and that in reality, we all have the opportunity to leave the world a better place. So, those are three things that I wish I had learned, that there was a class I could have taken in college. As you can see, I had a few bumps along the way, but I stand here before you, one humbled, but also a smarter person as a result of what I've experienced, and I don't think I would have traded it for anything. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Outstanding.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, I repent. No more stray trips to Kroger. So, we don't have a handout this morning, so in your small groups, just come up with your own questions. Basically, just react to all the stuff that Scott, I think we have plenty to talk about and digest as a result of Scott's great talk this morning. Let me pray, and then we'll close out. Heavenly Father, thank you so much for teaching us that. Scott's talk makes me think of that scripture in Proverbs that says, a righteous man falls seven times and keeps getting back up, but the wicked will perish by calamity. In other words, we're all going to fall. What are we going to do with that failure? Are we going to reset our mind back on you, Lord, or are we going to let ourselves get swept away by the current? That's certainly not the choice that we want to move toward. I pray that you bless our groups this morning and that you would speak powerfully through one another as you do when we meet as community. And I pray that in Christ's name. Amen. God bless y'all.